This morning, as I was preparing for class and for the lesson, I looked out of my office window, and the sun was coming right over the trees, and there's a little field area where we live, and it was shining brightly, lighting up the trees on the other side of the little meadow, little tiny meadow, and the field, and it was beautiful as it is. And then I realized, right smack dab in the middle of this sunshine, is a mother deer and its fawn. And I stopped and I watched them for a little while, and I realized how beautiful God's creation is. Right now, I'm overlooking another of God's beautiful creation. He is taking Christians, people who have been sinners, people who still sin, and trying to make us into the image of His Son. There's nothing more beautiful as those two deer were. There's nothing more beautiful than seeing you folks here today. If you're visiting, we're grateful for you. And if you expect something else than what we are about to do or what we have done, then please talk to us. Ask us why. We're here on a serious mission right now to help each other get to heaven, to do God's work. And if we can do it any better than we already are, we'll be thankful. And if we can help you, then we'll also be thankful for that. In the last 2 weeks, I'm about to read some headlines of the news. Now, if you pay attention to the news and you are politically minded, then this may conjure up in you feelings and emotions that I don't necessarily want conjured up in you for the politics of it. Let's leave the politics of it out if there are any in it. But think of a person living under the rule of God and His desire and what He wants for us in this world, and read these headlines and think, is this what God wants? The first headline: Christopher Lane, Australian baseball player killed by bored Oklahoma teens, police say. CBS News. When they were interviewed, these three boys, they said they were bored, they didn't have anything to do, so we decided to kill somebody for the fun of it. World War II vet Delbert Belton, 82, beaten to death by teens in Spokane, Washington. The teens appeared to have picked on him at random, authorities say. California Governor Jerry Brown signs a bill allowing transgender students to use restrooms and compete in sports based on their gender identity. Transgender students now able to use preferred bathroom in school. Whichever one you feel like that day, go into that bathroom. The same day, California passed, well, it came out of two conferences, Senate Bill 303, which says that organizations that discriminate on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientations are not exempt from the taxes imposed by the law. That's a minor step, but it is a step in the wrong direction. Church of Christ in Tennessee under fire for actions after same-sex decision. What happened here is the parents of a person who is not even a member of that church. The person who is not a member is a homosexual. And this person was demanding their benefits from the local town. They had to have their benefits. The parents, who are members of this church, were standing with them, saying, my child is homosexual, and he deserves, or she, in this case, deserves her benefits from the town. The church then said to the parents, you cannot support this type of behavior. You need to repent. You need to be exposing this instead of supporting it. And the church withdrew from them, and now the church is undergoing fire for having addressed the parents, not even the people themselves. I have permission to share this next. Anisha Martin, many of you know, is a midwife. I have permission to share this. They were recently approached and asked the following question by a woman who wanted Anisha to help to assist in delivering the baby. The question was, could her wife also be present at the birth? Now, understand what that means. It's a woman asking if her wife could be present at the birth. Almost half of first babies in the U.S. are born to unwed mothers. this is actually several months old. But the statistics I'm about to read are not several months old. Almost half. So if you go into a hospital and you ask, is this a newborn, a firstborn, is this a firstborn? And if they say yes, then one of every two, the parents are not married. In fact, when Marcy and I, when Marcy delivered little Nathaniel over a year ago now, they were so thrilled that both the husband and the wife were there together, mommy and daddy together. That just blew half the staff away right there. What a sad commentary on our society. Here are some, this is the Center for Disease Control statistics. The statistics are from 2010. Their report was in 2012, and this was just published the other day in August of 2013. Percentage of births considered non-marital. This down here is just first babies. This is dealing with all babies. If there's a baby out there that was born, the parents aren't together. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, 17%. Non-Hispanic whites, 29%. Hispanic, 53%. American Indian, Native Alaskan, 66%. Non-Hispanic blacks, 73%. What's going on? How do you feel about this? Is this what God wants? Is this a society that He has in mind? Oh, and facing overcrowded prisons, the U.S. wants to cut drug sentences too. What in the world? We sing the song America the Beautiful. America the Sick. Depraved. Diseased. And this is our home. This is home. You might think you live somewhere else, but I hate to destroy your Pollyannish point of view. But we live in a depraved and sick country. A survey of some certain situations may be helpful for us. Genesis chapter 6. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth. If you're not familiar with your Bibles, this is the account where God floods the world. Okay, this word wickedness, it's used many times. I'm just going to look at the times that it's used in Genesis alone. First of all, it can refer to, number one, murder, rape, and pillage. When Isaac was growing strong, and he's in the land of the Philistines, they're arguing about their wells. And finally, the Philistines realize, wait a minute, these guys are getting to be powerful. And so, because the Philistines think the way they do, they come up and make a pact with Isaac. And they say, that you do us no harm, that's our same word, just as we have not touched you or have done nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You understand that the Philistines are godless people, and when they say harm, what are they thinking about? Murder, rape, and pillage. That's what they're thinking about. This is the word that's used there. Adultery. Joseph says, there's no one greater in this house than I, and he, Potiphar, has withheld nothing except from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against you? Stealing. They had just gone out of the city and were not far off when Joseph said to his house steward, up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Now, obviously, his brother had not stolen it. It was all set up, if you know your Bible. But the idea is he's accusing them of having stolen, and it's called evil. It's that word. And then, jealously, plotting to kill family member, but selling instead, if that's any better. As for you, Joseph says to his brothers after his father dies, you meant it for evil against me, but God meant it for good. You understand the context here. And in fact, this isn't even talking about Sodom and Gomorrah, is it? So this is, when it says the wickedness of the earth, wickedness of man was great on the earth, it includes maybe all of these. Maybe more. I don't know, but these are the kind of things it can include. The wickedness of man was great on the earth. It doesn't matter where you go. The whole earth is looking. You can look at the universe and say, wow, the universe is impressive. It's a mystery. The universe is a mystery. And then you can look at the smallest part of the universe, the atom, and say, that's a mystery too. Here, the wickedness of man was great on all the earth. It didn't matter where you went. There was wickedness there. And then it goes on to say, that every intent of the thoughts of his heart. So the universe, the whole of the earth is the biggest, from the perspective of the biggest thing. And then just that one little thought, just take the tiniest little thought of a man out there. That single thought, he's looking at it under the microscope and saying that is also evil. The wickedness was great on all the earth and in everybody's minds. His heart, the thoughts of his heart were only evil. And only evil continually. Go to a maximum security prison. Who do you find there? You find the bad people, right? The people who have committed heinous crimes and maybe people who are repeat offenders. But even there, there are some people who have been sorry for what they have done. Not here. Here, everybody, save Noah, we understand. In fact, verse 11, the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted the way upon the earth. And God said, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. Understand this, first of all, as bad as things are right now, here, it's been worse before. Now the question is, what did Noah do? Look in verse 9. These are the records of the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. That can be a quality. It can also be an action. He's a righteous person. He's filled with righteousness. Or the action is he does things that are right. Okay? Whatever this means, look in the next. Blameless in his time. Now we understand. This man didn't do things that were wrong. Now he was a human, so he did sin. We understand that from other passages. But he's a good man trying to serve God. In fact, it says Noah walked with God. He kept his nose clean, we might say, despite all the filth that was around him. Everybody else was doing it, and Noah was saying, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to visit that place. I'm not going to do that thing. I'm not going to think that thought. Everybody else is doing it, but not Noah. It is possible to be the only one, he and his family. Turn also to Ezekiel 14. In the book of Ezekiel, what's happening here is God is going to bring the Babylonians. They're coming. And it's the end of the nation for Israel. And Ezekiel is wondering why, or maybe is there any other way? Can this be stopped, is his question. And God is explaining to him in Ezekiel 14 the depravity of the nation. That's the point of it. And he's also saying, look, when I'm finished with my plan, you'll understand why I did what I did, and you'll be comforted then. Chapter 14, verse 23. Then they will comfort you when you see their conduct and actions. After I've done everything, they're going to have repented, and you'll be comforted. But that implies how Ezekiel is feeling right now. God, does this have to happen? Do we have to destroy the nation? And God is saying yes, because they're so depraved. How does he prove that they're so depraved? Verse 14. Even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in its midst by their own righteousness, they could only deliver themselves. He says it again in verse 18. Even though these three men were in its midst, they could only deliver themselves. Verse 20, even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in its midst, they could only deliver themselves. Here it is, Ezekiel, he's saying, does this have to happen? He's begging God, no, anything else. And God points to Noah among others. Why would he point out Noah? He's saying here, even if Noah, Daniel, and Job were making intercessory prayers, they could only save themselves. What does this imply about what Noah was doing? He was praying. He was saying, God, is there any other, you want to destroy the whole world, is there anything else? And God says to Noah, I'm inserting my own little story here, if you will. God says to him, Noah, when I'm done, you'll be comforted. But in the meantime, what was Noah doing? He was grieving over all that he saw around him and what would happen to them. And that naturally leads us to 2 Peter, right? 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Peter describes Noah in verse 5 as a preacher or a herald of righteousness. What was Noah doing when the world was falling apart behind around him? He was living the way he ought to. He was sorry, praying, and he was trying to save these people, trying to snatch them from the fire. Isaiah chapter 24. Isaiah 24, Isaiah wrote around 740 BC, a little while before the destruction of Israel. He's writing about when, he's writing in the 8th century about what would happen in the 6th century BC. What's going to happen is Babylon's going to come along and take over the world. And when he does, he's going to make carnage out of every nation that is in existence. Well, why? Why do all these nations deserve such carnage? Chapter 24, verse 1. Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste. Listen to the language like Genesis chapter 6 here. The Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. That's the only difference. Here we have inhabitants. Genesis chapter 6, we didn't. The people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, the maid like his mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender. The world will be turned upside down is what's happening here. Things as you know it. The creditor like the debtor. The earth will be completely laid waste, completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourns and withers. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants. For they transgressed the laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are guilty. This sounds an awful lot like Genesis chapter 6, doesn't it? The whole world's going to be destroyed because the people who are living in it are polluting it. Again, we make the point, as bad as things are right now, it's not the first time things have been this bad. In fact, we seem to see some kind of a cycle, if not on all the earth, then in certain locations, definitely, like in Israel in the book of Judges. And maybe, I don't know, I'm not stating anything confidently here, but maybe in the United States we're coming down off of some kind of peak that we had. Not that we were ever that great anyway. I don't know what's going on. But the point is, things have been like this before. Now, the question is, or to go a little bit further, when it says, the earth is polluted by its inhabitants, Isaiah lives around 740. This includes Israel. Let's turn to 2 Kings real quick just to see what was happening right before Isaiah comes along. 2 Kings 15. There are three kings in the northern kingdom. And they all get whacked off. One, two. Actually, two of them get whacked off right in a row. 2 Kings 15. Verse 23, in the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, the son of Menahem, became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 2 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Stop there. You don't need to read more, and you understand things are not good. When the king is doing what is bad, then what's the nation doing, right? He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam or the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. Then Pekah, the son of Remaliah, his officer, conspired against him and struck him in Samaria and the castle of the king's house up with Argob and Aria. And with him were 50 men of the Gileadites, and he killed them and became king in his place. This is what we call a coup, and this implies instability. Anytime you have a coup, you have instability. Just look at the world around us, right? So there's one. Now look in verse 27. In the 52nd year of Azariah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, became king. Verse 28, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. Verse 30, and Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him and put him to death and became king in his place. There was a time in the first century, right around when Jerusalem was sacked by the Romans, that there were four, count them, one, two, three, four emperors in 1 year. That was not the high point of Rome's empire. Three kings, boom, 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 right here. This is saying things are not going well, and they're killing the Lord's anointed kings. Not anointed like David and his line, but anointed by the Lord to be there. Look in chapter 16. This is now in Judah. Verse 10, King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw the altar which was at Damascus. And the king sent to Uriah, the priest, the pattern of the altar and its model, according to all its workmanship. This story does not get better from here. So Uriah, the priest, built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. Thus Uriah the priest made it before the coming of King Ahaz from Damascus. So Ahaz is up here in Damascus. He sends the blueprints down. He says, build me this. Before he gets down there, it's built. Now he's going to come down. Verse 12, when the king came from Damascus, the king saw the altar. When the king approached the altar, he went up on it, and he burned his burnt offering and his meal offering and poured out his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of the peace offerings on that altar. Now listen. First of all, there's an altar already there. It's called the altar of the Lord's. And if you're going to do these things, you do them on his altar because that's what he said. Now, Ahaz says, that's not good enough. I'm going to do it on my altar that I have built. It gets worse. Verse 14, the bronze altar, which was before the Lord, that's the Lord's altar, he brought from the front of the house, from between his altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of his altar. So here's the house, right here. Here's the house of the Lord. And here was the bronze altar. And now he's put his altar down here, and the bronze altar up here. And they are both equal, is the point. You can go to my altar, or you can go to the bronze altar. Choose which one you will. His very own altar. Verse 15. King Ahaz commanded Uriah the priest, saying, upon the great altar, he's talking about his own here, burn the morning and burnt offering and the evening meal offering, the king's burnt offering and his meal offering and the burnt offering, the people of the land and their meal offering and the drink offerings, and sprinkle on it all the blood and the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice. But the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. And he has just totally substituted his altar for the Lord's. Now you have the king doing this. What's the example? And what are the people doing already? Verse 16. So Uriah the priest did according to all the king Ahaz commanded. And if this isn't bad enough, King Ahaz cut off the borders of the stands and removed the laver from them, and he took the sea of the bronze oxen and from the bronze oxen which were under it and put it on the pavement of stone. So he's taking all the things that the Lord has commanded that are for the Lord's worship, and he's taking them out and he's totally removing them. This is not what we call a recipe for success. This is how bad this place is getting to be. Isaiah, chapter 1, verse 2. If you can imagine for a moment what this king was doing, if you can't imagine it, imagine our leader starting to pray to Allah. It's the same thing. They're just saying, Jehovah, see you later. Don't want you anymore. I'm going to go pray to the king. Or even if they sacrifice to God, it's not doing it the way he said to do it, right? Then Isaiah chapter 1 also talks about the depravity of this time. Isaiah 1. In verse 2, listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons I have reared up and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its master, a donkey its master's manager, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Understand that that is not a compliment. You are dumber than a donkey is what they're saying. What God is saying to you, God's people. You're dumber than a donkey. Alas, sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who act corruptly. They have abandoned the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from Him. Where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? The whole head is sick. The whole heart is faint. The sole of the foot, even to the head. There is nothing sound in it, only bruises and welts and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, nor softened with oil. It's a body that is dying. It's on its last legs. And do you notice it said, the whole head, the whole heart, the sole of the foot, even to the top of the head. That's everywhere. There wasn't a grocery store. There wasn't a temple place. There wasn't a government office. There wasn't a home you could go into where this depravity had not sunk its claws. It was everywhere. So the question is, how did Isaiah, Micah, we haven't read from him yet, we're about to, and all the others who were living contemporarily with them, how did they feel? Turn to Habakkuk chapter 1. Habakkuk lives just after Isaiah writes. Verse 1, the oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw, how long, O Lord, will I call for help, and you will not hear? I cry for you, violence! I cry out to you, violence, yet you do not save. Why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Therefore, the law is ignored. Justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, justice comes out perverted. And all the while he's asking God, why do I have to look at this? Why do you have to make me see this? Why can't you just take the extractor button and hit it and take me out of here? Like you did with Elisha and Elijah, right? Why can't you just take me up in a chariot? I don't care if it's that. Just make my body go away and take me. Can you do it, Lord? That's the way he feels. In fact, Micah, in chapter 7, a couple pages back, from Habakkuk, Micah in chapter 7, woe is me, for I am like a fruit pickers, like the fruit pickers, like the grape gatherers. There is not a cluster of grapes to eat, or a first ripe fig which I crave. Okay, it's an analogy. He's saying, I'm like this vineyard harvester. I want some food. That's what I want. But it's not there. But what's the parallel to the, what is he talking about? Verse 2, the godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person among men. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. Concerning evil, both hands do it well. The prince asks, also the judge, for a bribe. The great man speaks with desire of his soul, and they weave it together. The best of them is like a briar, the most upright like a thorn hedge. The day when you post your watchman, your punishment will come. Then their confusion will come. Do not trust in a neighbor. Do not have confidence in a friend. From her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. Your very own daughter or wife or whatever the case might be, those closest to you, don't tell them your secrets because they are not to be trusted. This is what we call the falling apart of a family, isn't it? The family unit is gone. A man's enemies are the men of his own household. And how does he feel? Woe is me. This is the language of curses, isn't it? Woe to those who... He feels like he's been cursed. In fact, Brown, Driver, and Briggs says this word means to wail. That's how he feels. He's wailing. The NIV translates this, what misery is mine? The Net Bible, I am depressed. Why? Because of what he's looking for. I'm like the fruit pickers, like the grape gatherers. I want the godly person, but he's not there. Instead, there's everything else. Like somebody living in a refugee camp. Look, all they want is asylum, and they're denied. Destroys their life. All their hopes gone. That's what this man feels like here. So, the next question is, what do they do? Look at Micah 7:7. But as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Here he is enduring, living through this situation, living in perilous times, the worst of times he's living in. And what is he doing? Sounds a lot like Noah, didn't it? I'm keeping my nose clean. And here he says he's waiting for the Lord. Look in chapter 4. What is he talking about? I'm waiting for the Lord. What is the Lord telling him? Chapter 4, verse 1. It will come about in the last days. The mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. Anytime you read about the Lord's mountain being established, if you're a person of God, you say, even if you don't know what it means, it sounds great. Fantastic. I want to be there. I want to see that happen. Many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord. So not only are the Jews with God and His people, but here are other nations coming, streaming to Jehovah. That sounds good too. And the house of God of Jacob, that He may teach us about His ways, that we may walk in His paths. This is maybe the best part. Not only do these people want to be children of God, but the implication is they're doing His will. Now remember where they live. He lives in a place that it's totally depraved. And God is telling him about a place where the exact opposite is going to happen. People are going to be there. There's not going to be murder. There's not going to be this. There's not going to be that. There's not going to be all these things. There's going to be people doing my word. You won't read the headlines like we read earlier before. From Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and render decisions for the mighty distant nations. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning forks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will there be any war. It began with, God is going to judge. Remember Habakkuk said, how long are you going to make me look at this? What did he want? Judgment. God's saying, it's going to come. And then the rest of it is these people who are doing God's word, they're peaceable. What does it say? They beat their swords in the plowshares. They don't need it for war because there isn't any. Each of them will sit under his vine, under his fig tree. No one will make them afraid. The mouth of the Lord of the hosts has spoken. Though all the peoples walk, each of them in the name of his God. As for us, we will walk in the name of the Lord, our God, forever and ever. In that day, I will assemble the lame and gather the outcast. Even those whom I have afflicted, I will make the lame a remnant and the outcast a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion, for now and forever. As for you, tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you it will come. Even the former dominion will come, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. Now why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you, or has your counsel perished? That agony has gripped you like a childbirth. Writhe and labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth. For now you will go out of the city, dwell in the field, and go to Babylon. What he's saying here is, for now, all this is going to happen to you. But did you notice all that? Who doesn't want to live in this utopian-like society? Who doesn't want to be there? And this man, Micah, is saying, you're tickling my ears, Lord. Tell me more. Tell me more. Tell me more. He wants to be there. But the key word was, it will come about in the last days. In other words, right now, he's got to wait. He still has to live in this society that causes him to say, woe is me. I feel like I'm cursed here. Couple points from this. They worked on being content to live in deplorable circumstances, didn't they? It's like the person, the refugee in the cardboard box. Honey, I'm sorry, I know you hate it, but this is all we have right now. And that's where you stay. This does not mean they were content to sin. These people were not content to sin, more about that in a second, or to sit around and let things go on. They were prophets, weren't they? The ones we're talking about right now. So that means they practiced what they preached, they prayed, and then they preached. They weren't content to sit around, but at the same time, they had to be content to live in that situation. No eject button for them. At the same time, they looked forward to a better time. That's what we've been reading about here, isn't it? In fact, you can read about that on and on and on and on. And these are just a couple of the passages. We'll not turn there. But look in Hebrews chapter 11. In the book of Hebrews 11, in the book of Hebrews chapter 11, verse 36. It says, I'm jumping into the middle of the context. The idea is these people's faith saved them. We'll see that in a second. But it begins, or I'm going to begin with verse 36. Others experienced mockings. That's not nice. If you've ever experienced it, it's not nice. If you haven't experienced it, it's not nice. It means somebody's looking at you, pointing at you and saying, you're silly, you don't know what you're thinking, you're gullible, you're dumb. And scourgings. That's when they take a whip and whip you. Yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world is not worthy. These people were, quote-unquote, better than the rest. Nobody is good, but these were better than the rest. Wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. Why? Or what were they thinking while they were doing this? Living in this society where they were, quote-unquote, better than everybody else. Well, you see all these passages up here? They all talk about the same thing. A better time is going to come. A better time is going to come. They're living in the pits right now. And God is saying to them, a better time is going to come. A better time is going to come. And what is his point? Think about it. That's how you get through this. You think about these things. In fact, chapter 11, verse 16. As it is, they desire a better country. Keep that thought in mind. They desire a better country. Look in verse 13. All these died in faith without having received the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country that is a heavenly one. All the while, all these people who died in faith, not having received the promises, who lived in situations that are horrible, how did they do it? They just kept on thinking of that better place that God is always talking about. This brings us to a couple applications. Number one, the power of positive thinking, right? You don't have to turn to these passages. Ephesians chapter 6 talks about the slave and the master. Slave, obey your masters. All of them. Even the ones that are unrighteous. Why? Because you're thinking the whole while that God is watching over everybody. And he knows if you do something bad, you'll be punished for it. But if you do something good, God will reward you for it. How do you put up with the boss who is just terrible? Well, you know, God's watching. And good things are coming for those who are obedient to him, right? The same point is made for children. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you in the land. Children have parents that are just difficult to deal with. I'm one of them. On both sides. How does my child deal with it as he's growing up? Well, he understands my dad might be difficult, but I have to obey him because God said. How can I manage while I'm going through this? Well, I'll just think about the good things to come. So here's the point. The power of positive thinking. It can save you in times that are tough. It'll get you through those tough times. So my suggestion is get a positive thought. And here it is. 2 Peter chapter 3. Second Peter chapter 3, verse 11. All these things are to be destroyed in this way. Burned up is what verse 10 had said. Since this is the case, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and all godliness? So be obedient. Love people instead of retaliating with mean words and evil thoughts. Why? How can I manage this? Looking for and hastening the coming day of the Lord. Verse 13, according to his promise, we are looking for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. That is the happiest thought ever. You know, we started out with reading these headlines that make you just sick. Those headlines will not be there. Other headlines will be there. There won't be any bad to counter there. Everybody does good here. That's the headline. Who wants there? In which righteousness, doing what is right, dwells. That's what lives there. I want to go. Revelation chapter 21. Revelation 21, verse 1. I saw a new heaven and a new earth. This is figurative language describing what's going to happen. What is happening with the blessed. Verse 4. Verse 3. God is dwelling among them. That's enough. I'll live with God. Who wants to live with God? I'll raise your hand. I'll live with God. Verse 4, He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death, no longer any mourning or crying or pain. You know all those headlines? They're not even there. There is no crying. These things that make your heart and your face cringe, they're not there. Only good is there. Look in verse 8. The cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, immoral persons, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their part will be in the lake of fire which burns. They're not where you will be if you're faithful. So here's the idea. I know that there's something better than what we're going through right now. I know there is. God tells me there is. And I want to see it. And I'm going to do everything I possibly can to get there. Won't you go with me? Another thought. God does not take us out of this mess, does He? You know, when I was young, I started actually working for money when I was around 10 years old, a little younger, with my dad. By the time I got to be about 10 and a half, I couldn't stand it. Had to go to work all the time. Every summer, got to go to work. And I began to develop this thought, because I'd heard of this happening, that a chunk of money just might fall in my lap, and I wouldn't have to go to work anymore, would I? And so, as I grew a little older, mind you, I'm only 10, 11, 12, 13 years old here, I begin to almost rely on this. You know, when this money comes, I'll be okay. And so I'd spend whatever money I had because the chunk was going to come. And then it went on a little bit longer, and I started to think, if this chunk of money would just come, I'd be okay. And you see, my attitude started to shift, right? But the money never came. And that's when I realized it's not going to. And I just got to deal with it. I got to go to work. And my attitude changed towards work. God does not take us out of this mess. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. He is correcting them and how they misunderstood some instructions He had given to them. 1 Corinthians 5 verse 9. I wrote you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. If we stopped right there and didn't understand it, we'd say, okay, all of those headlines we wrote about, anytime we see anybody doing anything like that, we run as far as we possibly can. And then we end up in a little community, don't we, with gates and high walls and trees all around us. But that's not what he says. I did not mean at all the immoral people of the world, or with the covetous, or the swindlers, or with the idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world, because you cannot not find this stuff. It is everywhere. He doesn't take us out of it. Philippians chapter 2. Philippians 2:15, verse 14. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. You know, when God made diamonds, you know where He made them? Surrounded by dirt. And that's where they were. God's making you into the image of His Son. And while He's making that, do you know where you are? Surrounded by dirt. He is not going to take us out of the mess. So, accept it. Just accept it. He is not going to take you out. It's not going to change the world. So just accept it. And this, what this will do for you, instead of... That's nice. Instead of having this attitude where I can avoid whatever, you know, how do I avoid what's coming? Because guess what? You can't avoid what's coming. You cannot avoid it. You must face it. So your attitude will change from how can I avoid it to how can I make the best of the situation, or how can I try to change that person? And the answer, of course, is with the gospel. And then, finally, in fact, God wants us to stay in the mess, to save others, doesn't he? Philippians 2:15, you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent children above God, of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. You know, even if you wanted to, you can't leave. In Stalingrad, there's a battle during World War II, a long, very prolonged battle. It took months. In Russia, the Nazis were trying to break into Russia. This would have been, might have been, from all my reading, one of the battles that decided what was going to happen with the war. There were so many, the Russians, both the Russians and the Germans, understood this is an important battle, that they threw millions and millions of people as resources. And that's what they had people. So the Russians, they would either come in on boat or by train. And the infantry were told, when you walk out of here, you're going to face the Nazis shooting at you. And you'll have a choice to turn around and run back. If you do, we will shoot you and kill you. Either way, they were dead. They couldn't get out of the situation if they wanted to. God says, you stay in that situation. And if you have the wrong attitude, guess what's waiting for you? Hell. We can't get out of here even if we want to. You know, getting out of here is up to God. What we think about while we're here is up to us. One last passage and the lesson is yours. Philippians chapter 1. In some situations, we better not, or from one perspective, I should say, we better not even want to get out of here. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 21. Paul writes, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. If he lives, he's happy. If he dies, it's better. If I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me. And I do not know which to choose. I am hard-pressed from both directions. Look, Paul, if you could control this, would you die or not? You know what he says? I don't know. Why? Why wouldn't you go to heaven? Everybody would choose that, right? I am hard-pressed from both directions, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. Yet to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. If you were driving down the road with your family in a car and it plunged into a river and you were fortunate enough to escape out of your seatbelt, would you break the window and take off and leave the rest of your family there? Or would you try your best, maybe even drowning yourself, trying to save them? We can't have the attitude that is, Lord, take me out of here. Yes, we cannot wait because we understand it's better. But while we're here, we're trying to save everybody that we possibly can. Remember, God made the choice. You have to stay here. You make the choice whether or not you will like it. Paul said that he couldn't wait to die because he would be with Christ. The reason he can say that is because he had obeyed God's plan of salvation. If you have not, then God is being patient, waiting for you to come to him. If you reject him, you'll end up in hell. The plan of salvation quickly is to hear the gospel, to believe it, to confess, to repent, to be baptized in his name for the remission of sins, and then to live faithfully forever after. If this appeals to you, let us know as we stand and sing the song that's been chosen. 115 in the desert.